Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni, this is The Shocking Details.
Whoa, there we go. We got the little red ball. Nice. Hi there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined as usual by
Vincent Caldoni.
And also we got a special surprise guest this week. Would you like to introduce our guest, Vincent?
Our guest is Bonnie. Been on the show before. If you remember her Corona Chronicles episode, she has some amount of expertise in today's topic.
Hi again. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, welcome.
Glad to have you here.
Welcome. Yeah, we're going to be talking about dead bodies. I know a topic that's near and dear to you. So,
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But we're talking about body snatchers. Yes, a pretty sinister crew, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. But of course, last week we talked about Burke and Hare. Who are just household names, almost two of the most infamous, notorious murderers of all time. This week, we're going to talk about some other serial killers who were operating in London around the same time, although they didn't get busted until several years later. And we're talking about the Bethnal Green Gang, who were also known as the London Burkers when they finally turned up. They were body snatchers and worse. Yeah, they were a nasty bunch. And this story, I think, is actually more shocking than the Burke and Hare story. These people were worse.
Yeah, I'm surprised they're not more well-known.
That's the thing. It is less well-known than Burke and Hare, which is, you know, why? I don't know. There is some historical debate over just how many people are perps murdered. They ended up confessing to three. That's what they hung for, which was less than the Burke and Hare body count. Some people suspect they might have killed up to 20 times that many people.
I number myself among those people.
Me too.
So first, some background. As we noted in the previous episode, medical schools and anatomy schools were a growing business in the 19th century, and bodies were dissected in lectures so that people could learn from them and see what was, you know, going on in there. And also hundreds of students had to perform dissections themselves.
Yeah, these were students who were studying to become surgeons. So, you know,
So the demand was estimated to be something in the ballpark of 1,500 bodies per year for the London area. But executions, the number of, you know, like people they could get from prisons who carried out an execution, was something more like 50 or 60 a year.
Yeah, there was actually the Murder Act of 1752 only allowed the bodies of executed murderers to be dissected. They executed a lot of people for a lot of stuff back in those days. But, you know, they would execute you, as we said last week, for wearing blackface at night in London. But, but you couldn't dissect those people. Only murderers could be dissected. Yeah.
So for one thing, it was profitable.
What's that? Stealing bodies?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So a thing, which is what the body snatchers usually called their product, brought between 8 and 12 guineas. Mm-hmm. Starting salary for a new policed constable at this time was 50 guineas a year, whereas an unskilled worker made less than half of that.
Should we tell people what a guinea is?
I think we should.
Yeah, what is a guinea? Somebody know?
So I just learned this. I didn't know this. Actually, I've wondered about this for years.
Yeah, me too.
It's £1 and 1 shilling. Mm-hmm. They stopped minting the coins in 1813, but they were still in circulation for a long time after that. I guess higher end retailers like to price their goods in guineas because it made the price seem cheaper.
Mm. Yeah, apparently that's the way it worked. Is like people would just sort of do the math quickly in their head. Nobody had a calculator back in those days. So you price something at 39 guineas and people would just say, okay, a guinea is just a little over a pound. So that's about 40 pounds. So, okay, I'll buy it. And, but actually 39 guineas actually is 41 pounds. So it was a sneaky little way to get people to spend a little extra money. Like apparently that's what the whole thing was about.
Yeah.
So that's a guinea, just barely over a pound.
See, I didn't know all that history. I'm glad I finally learned that. The point is there was money to be made.
Lots
of people needing to make some money. So the graveyards of London, they started to empty out pretty fast.
In the 1820s, the job of body snatching kept getting harder. At around the time that our story begins, 1831, It's estimated that there were as many as 7 resurrection gangs in London, made up of maybe 200 men.
Ooh,
a gang could be anywhere from 2 to 15 men. And many of these were part-timers, you know, working a regular grift. Or hey, maybe an even honest job. And just acquiring and selling a body whenever the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah. And in fact, some of the veteran body snatchers actually complained about these dilettantes, as they saw it, who were horning in on their business. The real specialists were the guys who've been doing it for years, highly skilled. They were the guys that the anatomists at the medical schools really trusted to be discreet. Because let's face it, this was all pretty sketchy business all the way around. And so they wanted people who were discreet, who wouldn't inform to the police, and who would deliver a corpse when it was promised, you know? And these guys were the body snatching elite. And it's estimated there were maybe a dozen of these in London at that time. So not that many.
Speaking of complaints, the general public had some of those about the resurrection men. The snatchers were despised.
Oh, yeah.
And you can imagine why. I think that's pretty easy to understand. Mm-hmm. So as we said, the job was just getting harder and harder and more dangerous. Families were keeping watch over relatives' graves. And this didn't have to go on for very long, just like a week or two, until the body became too putrid to be sold. Also, armed guards are being positioned increasingly at London graveyards. These guys would have been more than happy to shoot a suspected snatcher, and no jury would have ever convicted them over it.
Oh, hell no.
No. Justified, if you ask me.
Yeah. So here's another little, we're going to spend a little time looking at the resurrectionist culture, and there was one kind of back in those days. And first of all, they had to have hangouts. Meeting places. And some of the known places around London, there were several of them. There was south of the Thames, there was the Bricklayers Arms and the Rockingham Arms. And then north of the river, there was the Rising Sun Pub and also the Fortune of War Pub. And the Rising Sun, by the way, is still there. But
cool.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to have to visit next time I'm in London. But unfortunately, the building that housed the Fortune of War, which dated back to the 17th century at least, was torn down in 1910, which is sad because I would have loved to have stopped by there for a pint.
And the Fortune of War is, that's famous for something else, too. I know I've heard of that pub.
Mm-hmm. It does put in an appearance in a short-lived TV series starring Sean Bean called The Frankenstein Chronicles.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that's where I actually started watching that on your advice.
Oh, did you? Yeah. It's actually better than the title would suggest. But
yeah, actually, I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, the writers actually incorporated quite a few historical details from that time. And they actually do incorporate this very story that we're talking about. Just sort of, it's not the main plot at all, but they sort of kind of incorporate it in there. I mean, there is some body snatching going on, and there is some action that takes place at the Fortune of War in that show. But the original Fortune of War, alas, is no longer there.
Yeah.
Too bad.
Oh, and the Fortune of War, by the way, was where our perps hung out.
So let's meet our perps.
Who are our perps? Tell us.
Well, in this case, they were John Bishop, Thomas Williams, and James May. Of the three of them, Bishop was the most experienced body snatcher. In 1831, he admitted that he'd lost count and really didn't know, but he guesstimated that he'd stolen and sold anywhere between 500 and 1,000 corpses.
Whoa.
Ooh, that's ambitious.
A lot of corpses, huh?
It's a lot of dead folks.
So let me ask you this, Bonnie, in your career in the undertaking industry, how many corpses did you handle, you think?
Oh, I don't know. Like hundreds, maybe? Not many, because I didn't stay in the business very long, but you know, depending where you work, smaller place, probably just hundreds. But if you worked at a corporate embalming place, you know, like a funeral home, probably hundreds, thousands.
Mm-hmm. Of course, if you're working at those places, people are bringing them to you. You don't have to go out and get all proactive and, you know, snatch them out of graves.
They
and
divide
stuff.
That labor up.
Yeah.
So the Fortune of War pub was where our perps, that's where they'd hang out.
Yeah.
And it had a prime location on Giltspur Street at Cock Lane.
You can still see it. You see the building that replaced it now on Street View, by the way.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So those streets are all still there.
Yeah.
Across the street from St. Bartholomew's Hospital, which of course had, you guessed it, an anatomy school.
Yeah.
And the owner.
Yeah, right. And the owner turned a blind eye to his body snatching customers. And in fact, he had a back room where they could stash corpses while trying to figure out where they could fetch the best price for him.
Yeah, that's apparently. Yeah, I mean, that's that would have been fascinating to go there and look in the back room. There's all these bodies laying around. Yeah. Hey, But yeah, that was a really handy little thing for them. They might bring the ticket to St. Bart's, you know, wanting to peddle a corpse. And St. Bart's is like full up on corpses right at the moment, so they don't want it. So you just stash it at the Fortune of War while you make the rounds of the other anatomy schools, like trying to figure out where you can get the best price for your thing, as they call them. Yeah, so handy. Yeah. Plus a full service pub.
That's great.
Yeah. Plus stash it was a nice place for the snatchers to hang out because, you know, they were, you know, reviled, as we said.
Yeah.
The Fortune of War was a nice haven for poor, sad snatchers. Were pretty much reviled everywhere else they went. It's said that the pub was more associated with the resurrectionists than any other, which may be a big reason why it was torn down.
Yeah.
And by the way, the building there now has a plaque on the corner commemorating the Fortune of War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, you can go to the spot. You just can't have a pint there.
What is the building, Joe? I haven't looked it up on Google or whatever.
You know, I don't know. It's pretty nondescript. It looks like your basic mixed use. It's either an office building or more likely maybe it's office retail downstairs and apartments up. Okay. I didn't.
I was curious if there was still a pub there.
I didn't see one. Alas, yeah. There should be.
So let's talk for a minute about the resurrection business then. There's the standard procedure, like you might see in the movies. You know, digging up a body could be accomplished in half an hour for an experienced snatcher. The coffins actually weren't buried that deep, so you didn't actually need to dig the entire thing up. So the preferred technique was to burrow down to the head of the casket, work iron hooks under the lid, and pull up hard until the lid broke apart, and then the body could just be pulled out through that hole.
Yeah, handy. That's why they did in gangs, by the way. Sometimes it might take a couple of guys to actually pull up on those things hard enough to break the boards. And then, of course, maybe you have somebody else to keep watch, you know, while you're doing this.
Yeah, I think a lookout man would be real important for this work.
Yeah, but yeah, then you just reach down through the hole and pull that body out.
Yeah, and if the dirt's nice and loose from a fresh grave, then it shouldn't be too hard to dig it up.
That's true.
Yeah, probably wouldn't be. Yeah, but if the body was, they were always careful about this because even though it was technically perfectly legal to steal a body because it didn't belong to anybody, other things did. So, like if the body, for example, was buried in a shroud, then the snatchers were always careful to put the shroud back in the coffin before they closed it up. And they would put the coffin lid back in place. Because otherwise, yeah, they could be accused of theft, which they could be prosecuted for. But the body was just fair game, you know, unless a relative showed up and shot you, of course.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Stealing the shroud would be the illegal part.
Yeah. Don't want to break the law, man.
Yeah. But there were other ways to get your hands on a corpse besides digging up a grave.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So as their trade got more difficult in London, the body snatchers were forced to get more creative. Sometimes they would approach relatives of the deceased and offer to buy the bodies. I don't know how often this worked, but I imagine at least occasionally. You have to imagine. A lot of people were desperately poor and would have considered a couple of quid to be almost life-changing. You know, still, it's pretty brassy to make an offer like that. Yeah. I imagine you'd probably want to approach the bereaved in groups of two or more for safety and support.
Oh, man.
That's weird. So the London gangs developed networks of informers out in the countryside. They often made trips to the villages around London where graveyard security wasn't quite as tight to dig up corpses. And sometimes they would swipe a body before it was even buried. See, in those days, if someone died, most likely their body would be kept at home for a few days before they, you know, did the funeral and the burial.
Yeah, they'd have them like maybe they'd have a wake or something like that.
Yeah.
Probably keep them at home and they probably had to at least give at least a day or two's notice to the relatives to come by for the wake.
No, that's right? True, because travel was so slow.
Yeah.
So, in fact, one of our perps, Thomas Williams, broke into a London home in October of 1831. William Sullivan, aged 14, had just died of an illness and his body was in a coffin set atop the kitchen table at his house. His widowed mother had to leave and run an errand. And when she got back, young William was gone.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Thomas Williams had been seen by some neighbors leaving the scene with a large, smelly basket. And from his description, the police ID'd and arrested him the next day. But by that time, the body was gone. Presumably, it had already been dissected at the school. And back in these days, no body, no case. The charges were dropped. So Mrs. Sullivan, grieving mother and widow, never got the chance to give her 14-year-old son a decent burial.
These people.
It's terrible.
These guys were, like I said, worse than Burke and Hare. These guys were just monsters. They didn't give a damn. about the damage they caused.
No, it's pretty awful.
It's really freaking awful. But it gets better than that. And speaking of Shameless, one of our other perps, John Bishop, he was, again, one of the, you know, probably the preeminent snatcher in London. He stole a few bodies from his own relatives in this fashion. And so,
oh my gosh.
I don't know. He was clever. He was working every angle he could, including murdering people, of course, but we'll get to that. But he relied more on tips and intel than in courage and daring. And so he was less likely to go dig up a corpse, although then, you know, he would do that. But he'd like to steal corpses from coroner's offices and from undertakers. If you got a tip that a body was lying in wake in a house, in a family's house, just like what we just talked about, he would stop by posing as a traveling carpenter and ask the owner if he could just rent a room for maybe a week, you know, or several days or whatever. And pay in advance, but then he'd skip out the first night with the body. Yeah, he had it down. He had every little scam for getting his hands on the body. He had them all figured out.
That's pretty creative.
Well, yeah.
Now another technique, and this is also very clever,
was to go
to the pauper's wards at the hospitals and pretend to be a relative of the poor dying person.
Mm-hmm.
And often the wives of the snatchers would do this, since as a resurrectionist might be recognized. But this could be tedious, as it often would take, you know, days for dear old Uncle Jake to die.
That's where the pillow comes in handy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, when he did die, the hospital would just hand over the body to his only known relative, you.
Yeah.
And then you were free to sell it.
Oh, and actually, the hospital is probably, you know, were more than happy to do this, because otherwise they would have been on the hook for burial expenses for whoever died on their premises. So they were probably more than happy to just hand the body to whoever wanted to claim it.
Yeah. And keep in mind, refrigeration at this time, probably not in its prime.
Nope, not at all. Of course, there was another shortcut to getting your hands on a saleable corpse.
What was that?
Burking.
Burking. We defined the term, the verb burking last week, I think, which is actually has two definitions. One is to murder someone by suffocation, but the more commonly used the understanding of the word is to murder someone and sell their body and or body parts.
That's how I understand that.
Did
our burkers hatch their plan at the Fortune of War? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, probably. That's where they hung out drinking. But
they sit around drinking beers and coming up with ideas.
Well, we get our hands on a body. Hey, I know. Let's get a little more proactive.
Yeah, but that detail is lost to history. It is known that James May was seen at the Fortune of War by the barman. His name was Henry Locke, washing a set of human teeth. That is, he was washing the blood off them. He had extracted them from one of their victims, a teenage boy. He told Henry Locke, the bartender, that he could get £2 for them.
Mm. Not bad.
Yeah, he actually got a little less than £2.
He did,
teeth was chipped.
And these teeth, by the way, were seen as somewhat incriminating by the jury later on, when these guys were finally brought to justice.
It's some damning evidence, I imagine.
He had extracted them from the corpse of a teenage boy that they had murdered. This is another really macabre aspect of this body snatching business, is that some parts were removed before you took them to the anatomist for sale. You'd pull the teeth out. Especially a youngster like this who had a fairly nice set of teeth, you know, you could pull all those out and sell them to a dentist. A woman's scalp with a full head of hair actually had good value.
Making wigs.
Yeah. Hard to come by a good wig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and this, of course, gave them some incentive, I think, to prefer young bodies over old, decrepit bodies.
Teeth
and gray hair, et cetera. Might be an incentive to maybe murder somebody. I don't know.
Totally.
Yeah.
Again, we don't know how long our burkers were killing people, but their string of murders ended on November 5th, 1831. They brought the body of a young boy, estimated to be about 14, to the School of Anatomy at King's College. The porter at the dissecting room, a man named William Hill, knew Bishop pretty well, as the school was a good customer of his. But when he saw the body, he noticed it was unusually fresh, and it didn't even look like it had ever been buried.
Yeah, I think that one of the phrases he used was actually suspiciously fresh.
Right. So Hill went upstairs and got Richard Partridge, a lecturer in anatomy, to come and see the body. He told him about his suspicions, and some of Partridge's students mentioned that they had seen notices that a child of around 14 had gone missing. So Partridge was very suspicious, but he told Bishop and Company that he'd pay them, but he only had a £50 note. So he asked them to wait while he went and got change.
But he went and got something else, didn't he?
No, he did.
Partridge went and got the police. When he came back about 20 minutes later, yeah, he had the coppers with him. So Bishop and Williams and May were busted.
And the police later searched their homes. They lived in a pretty slummy area called Nova Scotia Gardens. They found various articles of clothing buried there, indicating that more than one murder had been committed, likely. The body was believed to belong to a boy named Carlo Ferrari. Also known as Carlo Ferrari. In many accounts, he was an Italian immigrant to London, and some of the clothing that was found was identified as his by his friends. Also, upon autopsy, Carlo's stomach contents reeked of rum, and the police discovered that Bishop and Williams had bought half a gallon of rum at a nearby pub by their house. And also, there was the matter of James May and teeth that he was seen with at the Fortune of War.
Yeah, it all added up to kind of an incriminating picture. But it got worse for our perps, because they not only dug up Carlo's clothing, but they found some other clothing as well belonging to other people. They found some that appeared to be a woman's, and they put a detailed description of these clothing articles in the papers, and a couple of women came forward and identified them as belonging to one Fanny Pigburn, who had been missing for about 5 weeks. And this identification was actually pretty solid. Among the items was this handmade blue cloth purse that had been Fanny's, and one of the women had the very identical purse. An old woman had actually made these two purses, and then this woman and Fanny had each inherited one of them when the older lady died. So right. That seemed to really, really clinch it, I think, that Fanny was indeed the victim here.
John Bishop later confessed to killing both the Italian boy and Fanny Pigburn, as well as a third boy named Cunningham, who was about 10 or 11 years old. Oof. His confession came after his conviction.
And convicted they were.
They didn't waste any time back in those days either, did they?
No. Bishop and Williams were convicted and sentenced on December 3rd, 1831, and the hanging came just about 2 days later. Wow. The reporters reported that at least 30,000 people showed up to watch.
Yeah, it's good entertainment.
Oh, yeah. It's the only entertainment there was back in those days. But
Netflix.
Yeah, the day before his death, Williams and Bishop both expressed a desire to unburden themselves. They wanted to confess. Bishop wrote out a long confession stating that the murders were committed, first of all, by Williams and himself and no one else. And his confession and also Williams, they tended to corroborate each other pretty well. In fact, I think these two were kept in the same cell, so they had plenty of time to talk about this stuff. But they were pretty specific in letting their wives and their families off the hook for all this stuff. They made it very clear that nobody knew anything about it, along with a few accomplices like James May, who was part of their gang, but they didn't see any reason to take old Jimmy down with them. Maybe they were hoping that James would stay out of jail and help take care of their families after they were strung up. Of course, that didn't work out for them because May got convicted on some other charges anyway, but that's another story. Mm. Yeah.
The confession had a good description of the crimes, too. Bishop and Williams met Carlo, the Italian boy, on the streets in the Smithfield area, where the meat market of London was. They pretended to befriend him and offered him a place to crash for the night. Back home, they gave him some food and a glass of rum that they laced with laudanum. Carlo conked out pretty shortly. Here's an excerpt from Bishop's confession.
We took him directly, asleep and insensible, to the garden and tied a cord to his feet.
You're going to fool everybody with that accent, dude. sorry. I'm not being supportive here. Go ahead.
To enable us to pull him up by it. And then I took him in my arms and let him slide along into the well in the garden whilst Williams held the cord to prevent the body going altogether too low into the well. He was nearly wholly in the water of the well when his feet just above the surface. The boy struggled a little with his arms and legs in the water, but when the water bubbled for a moment, we waited till these symptoms were passed and then went indoors. About 3/4 of an hour, we returned and took him out of the well. We undressed him in the paved yard and rolled his clothes up and buried them where they were found.
How'd I do? What do you think? Am I fooling anybody?
Totally fooled me. And so that was a nice description of how they did it. And he also, of course, the confession described the murder of Fanny Pigburn as well, which was basically identical MO. Mm-hmm. Rum spiked with laudanum, cord around the ankles, head first into the well. Mm-hmm. And then
should we describe what laudanum is?
Laudanum is like, it was kind of like heroin almost, but it was widely used.
It's an opioid
yeah.
That also comes with heavy metals in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. So I don't actually know the exact makeup of laudanum, but it was very popular. Like Abraham Lincoln took it. It was commonly described for depression, of all things.
It was prescribed for practically everything, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Not much it else really to was. Prescribe.
I wish it was still around. Actually, it was incredibly popular. It must have been good.
I don't, I don't think mercury is something to take.
Well, a lot of people took it back in those days.
Yeah, exactly.
If it can cure syphilis, it can cure your headache, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And it did.
Yeah. But there are also some details on the murder of the boy named Cunningham. Do you want me to read this one in my Southeast Portland accent?
Yes.
I can also do it in my very charming British accent, but yes, okay, well, maybe I should not. We're losing listeners in Britain by the drop.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they're offended or having a good laugh. I have no idea.
I hope they're having a laugh. It's meant to be. It's a tribute to the lovely way of speaking that you people in the United Kingdom have.
Absolutely. I do admire the good old British accent. I like it a lot, actually. So, okay, let me just read a quick excerpt here about Cunningham. It was quote.
It was a fortnight after the murder of Pigburn. I and Williams found him sleeping under the pigboards in the pig market in Smithfield. Williams woke him and asked him to come along with him, and the boy walked with Williams and me to my house in Nova Scotia Gardens. We took him into my house, gave him some warm beer sweetened with sugar, with rum and laudanum in it.
And then remember, this kid is like 10, 11 years old, right? Yeah. I mean, how cold were these guys? I mean, oh my God, you drug and murder a little kid like this? I mean, okay, cool. Back to the quote.
And then he fell asleep in a little chair belonging to one of my children. We laid him on the floor, carried the boy to the well, and threw him in it. In the same way as we had served the other and the woman, he died instantly. We then took the body from the well, took off the clothes in the garden, and buried them there. The body we carried into the wash house and put it into the same box and left it there till the next evening when we got a porter to carry it with us to St. Bartholomew's Hospital, where I sold it to Mr. Smith for 8 guineas.
That's so cold. I mean, it's like you're sitting there watching this kid, you know, being, you know, you're going to murder him. He falls asleep in a chair that your own child normally sits in.
Right.
Dark, man.
Yeah.
That's twisted stuff.
These guys were the worst. Oh my God.
They were.
Well, they were. And you know, the thing I don't understand, and you know, maybe we're going to get into it, but it doesn't seem like London was like hurting for people for them to burke. Why go after a 10-year-old?
I don't know. I just, you know, it could be. Well, actually, based on the price that they got in, they only got 8 guineas. I was thinking for a second there that maybe somebody had expressed a desire at the anatomy school to get a younger subject.
But then they would have
made more than 8 guineas if that had been the case, I think. But they'd been, you know, specifically fulfilling a very specific order. So I don't know. I mean, but I think it was probably a purely opportunistic thing. Anytime they came across a kid by himself on the streets who appeared to be a lot of street urchins back then, just kids who were orphaned and just living on the streets. There are plenty of people to kidnap in Burke. Alas. But what happened to our heroes?
Bishop and Williams were strung up the next day on December 5th and their bodies were dissected.
Oh, yeah.
As for James May, he was convicted for a separate crime and sentenced to...
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Transportation for life to Van Diemen's Land.
Australia.
Right?
I think Van Diemen's Land, wasn't that specifically Tasmania?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it was. One of our listeners, somebody out there, look it up and let us know, okay?
No, I'm not. I can't do. I got to know.
Okay.
Let's see. We're looking it up right now. I'm going to cut this out. But
okay.
Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania. You are correct. It's not just Australia in general. It is Tasmania.
Okay.
So he was sent to Tasmania. But some accounts have him actually dying in 1834 down under. But the best account that we've come across says that he never actually made it out of London. He boarded the ship, the Justitia.
Something like that. Wow, weird name for a ship. I don't know.
We're not scoring well on this one. Yeah, I don't know what that says, but
sure.
It doesn't really matter. It's just the name of the boat. So they're going to transport him on this ship, but then his health underwent a sudden sharp decline, and he was transferred to the hospital ship, the Grampus. What are they naming these ships?
I don't know.
I like Grampus better than this D-ship myself.
Yeah, then we went to the Grotus.
Yeah.
which was moored off of Greenwich, and he died there in January of 1832.
Yeah.
The cause of his sudden illness is unknown, but newspapers suspected that other transportees on the Justitia were less than keen on having a body snatcher aboard.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. They might have poisoned him, you think?
The poison would probably just beat him half to death, more likely.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And the thing is that the sailors on board who were running the ship were probably even less keen, because sailors, being a superstitious lot, probably were worried that having somebody like him on board would bring them some bad luck at sea.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
You get the
wrath of the gods called down upon you for transporting somebody like this. You know,
yeah. Right? Yeah.
So I wouldn't want him on my ship. I mean,
yeah.
So yeah. So just days after the hangings, the papers began to report that John Bishop and was it Thomas Williams? I've forgotten my own perps names already. Hang on.
Just say Bishops and Williams. That's what you wrote.
I'll just say that. Okay, hang on. Let me start this over again. So just days after the hangings, the papers began reporting that Bishop and Williams had actually began to confess to 60 murders.
Whoa.
But that the authorities at Newgate Prison, who were overseeing their confessions, had essentially allowed them only to write out the details of three, which were, of course, the ones that they were suspected of and convicted.
Why?
Yeah, why? That's a good question. This is part of our mystery here. And this issue actually was raised in the House of Commons a week after the executions. Basically, the question from in Parliament was, well, what did Her Majesty's government know about this?
Mm-hmm.
To which everyone replied, "The official confessions are the only ones we know about," which may have been entirely true. It's not like the papers then or now were above publishing BS, right?
Yeah, true.
But on the other hand, the discovery of these murders was a big hit to the reputation of the medical profession. Yeah. And this is coming right on the heels of last week's perps, Burke and Hare, no less. So it is possible that the sanitized versions of this confession were released to keep the medical schools from being shut down. I mean, that's a pretty reasonable speculation.
Yeah.
It's also not hard to believe that 60 people could disappear from the streets of London without being missed back in those days. That can happen.
Oh, hell yeah.
People were arriving every day, and the medical schools need a lot of corpses.
So there you go. I mean, yeah.
There you go.
We could talk about the why to believe one or the other of these in our theories about this mystery. But first, I think we need to take a commercial break, don't we? We better do that. People want to hear from our sponsors. I know.
We do. Buy their stuff.
Yeah, buy their
stuff. Tell them Caldoni sent you.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Okay. So we'll be right back.
And we're back. So I don't know what they were selling, but buy it. Okay. So we got some theories here. We got a mystery, which is, how many people did our perps murder?
Yeah.
Was it three? Was it 60? Was it more? God knows how big how big the body count was with these guys.
Right, right.
I mean, there's no limit in terms of like morality. I mean, certainly, I think we've established that these guys were sociopaths and didn't give a damn, and would have killed their own mothers probably if they'd been could have gotten 20 quid for the corpse. Mm-hmm. Seriously. So there's not a limiting factor in that sense. I mean, they certainly would have been more than happy to kill people. There's also the question of why John Bishop rented the house that he lived in, why he rented that particular house in that location.
Well, I mean, but how does that work? Play this out for me, Joe. So he gets the house.
Well,
it's got its own well.
Well, that was it. Did he rent it because it had its own well that he could drown people in? Now, Nova Scotia Gardens was a pretty downscale neighborhood, and that area had been previously mined for clay deposits. And so it was like basically quarried out. And so the neighborhood was built in this depression, this enormous depression in the ground. And so it had a tendency to flood a lot. Hmm. And it just wasn't that great of a neighborhood anyway, not a high quality, area. He really, with the amount of work that he did, snatching bodies and everything, he was making a pretty good living. He really actually, I think, could have afforded a house in a better neighborhood. And yet it's got its own well. And if he and Williams were really regularly into murdering people, by the method that they chose, which was they wanted something that would look like a natural death. For example, Burke and Hare suffocated people so they didn't leave signs of violence on the body. And these guys, well, their preferred technique was to drug them and then just push them into the well to drown. The well was a very handy feature. And I'm assuming that not that many houses in London in those days had their own wells.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. I mean, they definitely had public wells.
Yeah. And so if he rented the house for that reason, for access to his own well, for murder, then he and Williams must have been drugging and drowning people for well over a year. Again, July 1830 is when he rented the place. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the three murders that he and Williams confessed to didn't actually happen until late 1831. That's one reason I suspect that perhaps they killed a lot more people.
It was up to the whole time. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a reason, I think. What do you?
Right.
So also the British Home Office took an interest in the case, which would seem unusual for a death among London's wretched poor. Mm-hmm. And after the body came into the possession of the police, a coroner's jury was convened to determine whether a murder had been committed. The jury reached its verdict. Yes, this boy was murdered by someone on the evening of November 10th, 1831.
That's when they reached their verdict, not when the murder took place. Yeah,
no, obviously. Yeah. Yes. The clerk in charge of the jury was James Corder. He delivered a note to the Home Secretary, William Lamb, the Viscount of Melbourne, and the future Prime Minister, at his home at 11 p.m. that very night. Hmm. So this seems like there's a high level of urgency. Like, was this setting off some alarm bells within the government?
It seems like it was.
Right.
Seems like a lot of high level people were kind of, you know, interested in this whole story.
Seem very interested.
Mm-hmm. So Bonnie, you've seen the note. What was in it?
Here's an excerpt from the note.
The inquiry into the present case has been the means of eliciting the fact that several boys of a similar age to the deceased have recently been missed by their friends, and there is too much ground for justifying the conclusion that they have, with him, been the victims of a horrid system carried on for some time past by wretches whose business it is to supply the hospitals.
Unquote. Oh, ouch. And so, you can see why the government, the police, everybody would consider this to be a pretty huge, embarrassing scandal.
Yeah.
So how many children had vanished from the streets of London? And no one knows. Maybe the police and the Home Office had some idea, but they weren't talking. And it's entirely possible they had no idea themselves. In fact, more it's likely they had no idea how many vanished. Nobody knows. How could you know? Nobody knows who was there to begin with. You know, that's what made Birking such an attractive proposition in London in those days. And the truth, of course, if they did have some idea of how many children actually had disappeared, maybe they had actually been compiling reports of disappeared people, and they'd noticed a hell of a lot of people disappearing, but they kept it quiet because the truth would have been really embarrassing, as I said, for the government, police, the medical profession.
Yeah. Well, that kind of dovetails in with the sort of my riff on this theory, is that I think they may have shut Bishop up and put the kibosh on this whole story because they wanted to stop this from spreading further and making not just the medical profession look bad, not just the university system look bad, but that there may have been individuals with connections to government from families who had, you know, royal ties or parliamentary ties working within those institutions who would have been, by extension, at least somewhat culpable in Bishop and Williams's murders.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes sense too. That's a good point as well. Yeah, the aristocracy was probably involved with those that whole thing.
Yeah.
And you know, the whole medical thing was like the medical profession at that time, and because of things like all the bodies being dissected, a lot of people considered that to be rather sacrilegious.
Yes, it was not a popular thing.
It was not, and especially the poor, who were definitely in the majority back in those days, were noticing that the people getting dissected were pretty much 100% the poor. And they kind of felt like they were just as entitled to a decent burial as anybody else. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, there were a lot of people who really were feeling pretty antagonistic towards the medical schools back in those days. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing they didn't succeed in shutting them down. I'm totally sympathetic to their concerns, but you know, we do the medicine. The medical thing is kind of good. The medical thing, you know, that's a modern medicine is a nice thing.
I'd rather be treated by a doctor who has a large body of scientific information and data backing up the decisions he makes about my treatment, as opposed to some ignoramus who's drunk off his butt and doesn't know what he's talking about, which is what most doctors were back in the day.
And I mentioned this in a previous episode, but I've got to repeat it anyway. I saw this great meme on Twitter. It was like being an old timey doctor would have been great. I'd be like, yeah, it looks like you've got ghosts in your blood. Better do cocaine about it. Yeah. It summed it up pretty nicely.
Treatments were great. Cocaine, morphine, whatever.
A little laudanum, some mercury. Yeah. Here we go.
That's how I go to bed.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that'll put you out.
So let's
talk about the theory that there were not more murders.
Yeah. I guess there's that. There's no documentation, is there?
No. No. That's really what it comes down to. There's not much more to say about it than that. It seems like, you know, based on their confessions that they were making in prison and sort of the way this lines up, like, they just seem too organized and too practiced to have only done this three times.
Oh, yeah. They had it right down to a science. Okay. You give them the rum laced with laudanum and you tie the rope around their ankles when they pass out and into the well. Right. They go. Yeah. Seems like
I feel like you've had practice if you have no problem with taking out a 10-year-old child.
Yeah. That doesn't seem like your first or even second rodeo.
Right.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like we were saying, there just isn't the documentation for this. We can't prove any of it.
No, we can't. Mm-hmm. But I can't. I think these guys would have been happy to kill hundreds, you know, whatever, as long as they made some money on it.
As long as there's a demand.
Yeah. I think where they really screwed up is they didn't let the Italian boy, the one that actually got them busted, they didn't let him sit long enough. They probably should have let him ripen for a couple more days before they took him in.
Yeah.
Sorry for my crude language.
No, maybe I see what you're saying.
But maybe they just got a little too arrogant, or maybe they were just in a rush and really needed some pocket money right quick. I don't know. But they should have let him sit for a few more days. And then that whole thing about him being just a little too fresh.
Wouldn't have caught up to him.
Yeah, would not have been such an issue. So maybe that's what it is. Maybe they were being a little more careful and they just got a little careless there. And then, whoopsie.
Yeah, I kind of suspect that. But like we said, we can't prove any of that. So.
And by the way, speaking of the Italian boy, I did want to give a shout out to author Sarah Wise, who wrote a book about this very thing.
Yeah, I have that book around here somewhere.
Oh, do you have that book? Yeah, so do I. It was a good source for material about this. There's other sources out there as well, but this is a great book, by the way. If you want to read about these guys, the London Burkers, in much greater detail, I definitely recommend her book. So it's called The Italian Boy by Sarah Wise. Give it a read. Yeah.
Give it a read.
Yeah.
So there's a little epilogue to this story.
Yeah.
And I'm going to actually kind of riff on this in a second, too.
Yeah.
The Anatomy Act of 1832 and the Murder Act of 1752 required that only corpses of executed murderers could be used for dissection.
Yeah.
An anatomical society was formed in 1810 to lobby Parliament to change the law. The Burke and Hare murders moved public opinion to favor a change in the law, and the London Burkers caused even further changes. The Anatomy Act gave schools and students legal access to unclaimed corpses, mainly people who had died in a hospital, workhouse, or prison.
Mm.
And one argument against the bell was that it would deny poor people a decent burial.
It's true. Good but point. At the same time, it had the beneficent effect of cutting the body snatchers out of the, you know, out of the whole loop there. Because again, the poor usually were the ones who did wind up being buried in shallow graves in unguarded cemeteries. And they were the ones who got dug up and dissected anyway. So, you know, at least it took that whole thing out of, you know, those criminals out of the picture. So that was a good thing.
Yeah. So in this time, you know, around the time of Burke and Hare, and honestly before that, there were big movements to outlaw basically anatomical dissection and to restrict access to it. You know, when you chart it over hundreds of years, there are changes in people's feelings about it, but it generally was considered pretty taboo in, at least in the Western world, in places like the US and the UK. And that had that and all the regulations and restrictions actually had a fallout that you can trace even to this very day. So the way that you would look at someone, right? So say you go to the doctor, right? And that doctor looks at your thymus and sees that you have an enlarged thymus. How does he know how big that thymus is supposed to be?
Yeah.
That is a result of years of medical research. We have data on this. Back in the 19th century, when these restrictions were put into place, we were generally getting our corpses from these extremely restricted sources, right? Yeah. And that led it to be, you know, like poorhouse, workhouse, places like that.
So not necessarily a representative sample then, huh?
Well, one thing that was going on in the 19th century is there was a lot of heavy metals in the water.
Oh, yeah.
Heavy metals in the water will cause you to develop a small thymus.
Hang on, I'm feeling my thymus right now.
Don't even know how you
Okay, forget it.
So having an enlarged thymus puts you at an extremely high risk for later in life. And in the 20s, I believe it was 1926, according to this paper I have in front of me, having an enlarged thyroid can, an enlarged thymus puts you at risk for thyroid cancer. I believe that is legit. So when we go back to 1926, a physician, I had his name, but I don't have it now. Hempelman, I think? Yeah,
it was Hempelman. Dr. Somebody.
Yeah, I might have that wrong, but he developed a treatment where you just blast the throat with radiation.
Yeah.
X-ray, I believe. And that causes a retardation in the growth of the thymus, which then was thought to prevent the development of thyroid cancer later in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, plus radiation, you know, you can never go wrong with radiation, frankly. Just kidding.
This treatment was detrimental. They used it from 1926 up until 1957, and it caused thousands of cases of cancer, as well as lots of other diseases that you get from having too small a thymus. Mm. So essentially, they were using an X-ray machine or some device like that to give you the thymus of a 18th or 19th century peasant who'd been drinking lead his whole life.
Yeah.
And it made people who are alive to this day, like people living and walking around, very sick. And people still deal with the fallout from that. And that goes all the way back. You can trace a straight line all the way back to people like Burke and Hare, and that it interrupted the ability of the sciences to get accurate data on just like just how big your thymus is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of crazy that these body snatching stories that we that we're studying actually still have fallout to this very day. That's pretty wild, man.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. But yeah, so the dead hand of history is always upon us, you know?
Also, I just want to correct myself. I was entirely wrong. Hempelman was not the guy who invented this procedure. He's the guy who put a stop to it.
Oh, okay.
So I have that totally backwards. He did a study in the 50s that concluded that this was actually giving people cancer and making them very sick.
Mm-hmm. Well, luckily they discovered that before I was born. That's a good thing.
Yeah, thank God.
yeah, and actually it was generally young men who that they were blasting with this radiation. So you would have been a candidate for it if you'd been born earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, it just goes to show you, they'll be looking back on this time 100 years from now thinking, oh, my God, look what they did to those poor people.
Those barbarians.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, that's how that goes. But yeah, and it, you know, I think it, I don't know, part of why I like these stories, and I'm sure Bonnie might be able to speak to this, is I think it does show that we have some very complex feelings about the dead, about dead bodies.
Oh, and absolutely.
And it really moves us when we hear these stories about people stealing corpses and anatomy, you know, professors and stuff like that. Like it has a big fallout.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that, Bonnie?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I mean, it's been like that for centuries, and it's still, we have very strict laws in place to prevent mutilation, mistreatment of bodies. And I feel like that's going to continue on probably forever, sure. Maybe.
No, it's like I'm even, you know, obviously, you know, with my own family, friends, loved ones, whatever, you know, I would be very, very sketched out if somebody messed with their corpse at all. I mean, just last year, my cat died. And this veterinarian asked me if I wanted to, you know, have him cremated. And I was like, you know, no, because I'm not saying I don't trust you, but I don't trust whoever you're going to give it to actually do what they say they're going to do rather versus throw my cat's body in a dumpster, you know, and present me with the contents of an ashtray or something and say, yeah, this is ashes, you know? I mean, so that's how serious it is. Maybe I'm tweaky about this, but even I even want my cat's remains to be treated with respect, you know? Right. And so, yeah, I don't know why that is. I mean, but it just is. It doesn't really make sense, I suppose, but, It does seem to be kind of deeply rooted in our, you know, either in our society or maybe it's in our DNA. I don't know.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, people had a visceral response to this. Yeah. It's actually pretty crazy in the research that we've been doing for these two episodes, reading about just how, 30,000 people showed up to see this guy get hung.
Uh-huh, yeah. I know.
That's pretty amazing. That's a lot of folks, man.
Yeah. And then, of course, in the case of Burke and Hare, when Hare was let go, he everywhere he went, there was a lynch mob waiting for him, you know, and the women folk as well. So, yeah, people took that stuff seriously back in those days, and they still do, I think.
Idea.
Yeah, hopefully.
All right, well, happy Halloween.
Yeah, I know. I hope we've sketched you guys out with yet another creepy macabre episode.
Yeah.
And
well, yeah, let's wrap this one up. We're going to give you guys information on how you can get in touch with us. Please hang on for that. And please find us on social media.
Yeah.
And definitely do not forget to write us a review.
That helps us so much.
And other reviews, we read them. We will thank you for them.
Yeah.
And Bonnie, always, speaking of thank yous, thank you for coming on the show.
Big thanks. Thank you. Glad to be back.
Yeah, Bonnie.
It was a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, it was great to have you. And I'm sure we'll have you on again one of these days. And by the way, stay tuned, because we're always going to need information about undertaking and stuff like that as well. But until next week, when we're going to be back with an even creepier story, if we can find one to round out your Halloween experience. Until then,
I'm going to try to find a creepy one that does not involve drowning little boys.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. Yeah. anyway, so we'll get something. Promise.
All right.
Till then, ciao.
Ciao.
The shocking details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.